Hello everybody, welcome to Infection Control Matters from ECCMID, and I'm sitting next door to Brett.
G'day man.
Yeah, good.
There's a bit of a hum in the background.
There's a bit of a hum in the background. It's probably the hum of everybody's phones trying to download the latest version of the app.
It hasn't been a very successful
app. It's shocking.
But nonetheless, we've managed to get to a few sessions this morning.
Yep. Went to the environment one, and a couple of nice papers there from Hilary Humphreys and Kath Noakes. Do you want to talk about Hilary's session?
Yeah.
So Bruce killed you, Bruce.
He did call me Bruce. We'll have to talk to him about that.
We will.
Look, that was an overall session. It was about design of healthcare environments to minimise infections. And unfortunately, we missed David Weber's talk. And we only caught the back end of one of the architect's talks. And that was... I'll blame the app for that.
Yeah.
But we did get to hear Hilary. So he provided a nice little overview... Started really, his title of his talk was around water and the risks of water as it relates to healthcare associated infections. But he started really talking about the environment more broadly. And I think one of the key take-homes for that for me was there's still a real lack of high quality evidence around the environment. And when we mean by high quality evidence, I'm talking about that sort of randomized control studies. And inherently, because of that, there's a whole range of bias in a lot of the studies that are out there. But he did highlight some of the good papers were out there, and then moved on to water, and really highlighted then that there's even less evidence for what we're dealing with, but did highlight some interesting challenges.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the one thing everybody keeps missing is if you look down the drains, you find loads of stuff. Well, what a surprise, because we put loads of stuff down the drain from... all ends of the
and
body.
He did touch on sinks as well.
He did, but nobody's really looking about coming back out again. You know, Amy Mathers did a bit of work, Mark Garvey did his sink splash zone. You know, let's just get down to some practical nitty-gritty stuff and almost put a 2 meter barrier around a sink and say nothing goes within that area, especially not in an ensuite room, the patient's toothbrush. Because
you can
guarantee a splash from the drain is going to land on the toothbrush and they're going to stick it in their mouth and clean their teeth.
Yeah.
So it's time for some practical things. But that all gets, you know, everybody goes on about, well, we sequenced all the stuff down the drain. But it's, how does it get back to the next patient? How do they eat something that's down the drain? Or how does it get into their gastrointestinal tract? And that sort of gets a bit lost, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think I often caught up in a lot of the other stuff. And there's, you know, obviously some important things. We've been talking about biofilm formation, all the rest of it. But actually, really what we're interested in is how do we stop it from getting A to B?
Yeah.
And that's actually what we're really interested in trying to do here.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm in.
And for a gram negative, it's only going in one way, unless it's going to crawl up your legs and go in then the other way. There's only one way in.
Yeah.
So.
And he did touch on drain covers as very briefly. But of course, they're going to get biofilm formation very quickly as well and become contaminated very well.
But the drain cover just stops a splash.
Stops a splash, yeah.
But actually, just remove things from the area that could get splashed.
Yeah, yeah. Or, and I think we saw in a previous conference work around design of sinks to try and reduce the amount of splash that you get. And someone actually asked the questioning of Hilary about filters, and it was an interesting question because I think the question I think was, I'm not sure whether the question was related to filters pre the water coming out or other types of filters.
I think it's filters pre the water coming out, so it goes on the tap,
which is no point at all.
Unless you've got Pseudomonas in your system, okay.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is, you're going to hit perfectly filtered water onto a drain, which is then going to splash.
Yes, so. That's right. And I think Hilary started his talk by making the point that... it was one assumption, or it was actually two assumptions, I can't remember what the second one was, but one of those assumptions was that the water going into hospitals and healthcare settings is clean and drinkable.
Yeah.
And so it's what does it happen after it gets into hospitals that causes the problem.
Yeah.
And so I don't really think the filtration issue was, I think it's a bit of a red herring, but... Anyway, so it was an interesting discussion.
It was a tour de force. I mean, how he fits all of that into a short session, really fantastic.
Yeah, it was. It covered an enormous amount in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then Kath Noakes came on.
Yeah. Really excellent speaker as ever. Yeah. You know, good practical stuff. She did touch on the new WHO the transmission pathway.
And we're actually going to explore that in the next 24, 48 hours. Well, this won't come out in the next 24, 48 hours. It'll be our next podcast, perhaps, but after this one, maybe.
It will be, because this will put out fairly quick.
But the WHO have got new guideline with regards to air, but in that they've actually got a new framework for the way in which we would have traditionally described transmission-based precautions.
Yeah.
And so there's new terminology proposed to describe the three mechanisms of transmission.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that.
Yeah.
We'll get into that in the next podcast.
Yeah. Oh. I better not have a glass of beer before I start discussing puff clouds, that's for sure.
No.
Otherwise, that's not going to go very well.
But the thing I really liked and appreciated, Kath's, well, there's so much good stuff in there. But
yeah.
I think there's some really simple things in there that people forget about. And we're not going to go into these transmission, new transmission pathways, but just on the airborne transmission pathway route, she made the point about ventilation really addressing that pathway. And what we and in that context also, not near patient transmission via particles, rather long transmission.
Yeah.
And she defined that as more than 2 meters. And really, that things like ventilation will have minimal impact potentially on some of the other types of transmission. So I think that's a good way to frame that whole talk.
Yeah.
And then while it went into all the different, again, it was a whirlwind of a lot of information in 30 minutes of from all the different ventilation-related requirements and discussions.
And we just ambled along to a flash poster session, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah. Couple of interesting presentations there. There was one from the group in Monash in Australia looking at VRE and an outbreak of VRE they were experiencing in one of the hospitals there, and they wanted to determine whether the environment was the source of that. They swabbed patients, they swabbed a lot of the environment. The thing I actually found interesting about, well, one interesting about that flash poster presentation was 20% of the samples that they took from the environment, they found VRE in. That's extraordinarily high. I thought it's really high.
Do you know, I think it's in many environments and we don't pick it up because we don't see many clinical infections in many areas with it. You do in areas where there's really immunocompromised people with lots of line access, but on general areas, I'm not sure we go looking. And I know Tim Boswell and Nick Mahida did a few years ago a sampling of socks that people walking around on the floor because they didn't want them to fall over, so they put non-slip socks on, and 80%+ had VRE on them.
Yeah. That's huge. I guess you expect there's a lot of contact.
Yes.
There's a lot of contact or a lot of surfaces you walk around with socks on. But I thought 20% was high. It was just a simple swab, as I understood they were using.
But it does survive quite some time, so who knows when it was deposited.
That's right.
You know, and there's a lot of colonised people probably going through our organisations that we don't really know about at all because we don't swab everybody.
And they didn't screen for those patients.
No.
Anyway, so they did genomic work, compared that to the clinical isolates they were found. They essentially found two different sources. One, there was a very distinct group that were related to clinical and patients, and one that was in the environment. And there wasn't a lot of overlap between using genomic transmission between the environment and those clinical sources. So I guess their take home from that was the environment in this outbreak, there were two different things going on. There were environmental sources of VRE, but there wasn't much of that was the cause or links to the transmission in some of those clinical isolates that they were seeing.
Yeah, because you could easily jump to the wrong conclusion, couldn't you, unless you're doing sequencing.
Yeah, that's right. So that was an interesting one. And then the next...
The Berkhold area was quite interesting. So UKHSA, which is the United Kingdom Health Security Agency, presented a nice abstract on a Berkhold area problem related to an eye gel. And they'd noticed an increase in cases of a particular version of Berkhold area, and noticed that actually quite a few of them were coming from eye-related samples. And they managed to track it down to a particular form of particular eye gel, not manufactured even in Europe, which gave challenges in itself. But the manufacturer voluntarily withdrew this. And the question we were both mulling over, and somebody else asked, was, did you actually manage to track down exactly what the source is in the manufacturing process? And the answer to that was no.
No, because they were overseas.
Because they were overseas.
And they weren't down by the regulations.
Well, that's the thing. So that sort of thing is probably going to be classed as a cosmetic.
Yeah.
Which means you don't have to test for it.
Mm.
And even if you do test for it, and evidently the manufacturer had tested for it and didn't grow it, you don't grow it with conventional methods. You have to use specialist methods for growing Berkhold area, especially if it's getting into the system in a biofilm and then grows up later in the gel. So if you test it at source and it's still in biofilm, you won't grow it.
Mm.
If you test the gel eventually, then you probably would grow it.
Yeah.
So, and that's the problem with regulatory concerns. You know, if it was a medical device, maybe you'd have certain standards to meet. As a cosmetic, you won't.
Yeah. And there's a mix of both, because the speaker alluded to the fact that you could buy that over the counter. So clearly it is a cosmetic. And also it was prescribed for certain things as well.
Well, that was interesting because they were staying and they were still seeing the odd case, and that's probably because people are buying something over the counter and a chemist somewhere has got a bit of stock kicking around.
Yeah.
And the general public probably won't get that many infections, but in hospital you do, so you pick up the cluster from there, and that's why you've got a long tail on it.
That's right. And I think the other potential reason why there was a bit of a tail was because people would buy that product.
Yeah.
They'd have it and use it at home.
Yeah.
They might actually use it straight away. They might be running out of their other product. And so they're not going to be aware of these cups of recalls more than likely.
Well, they might use it for a little while and then put it back in the drawer and then reuse it, by which time the cap's been open for a while and who knows.
Yeah. I did like also the way it was. I think it was a really neat presentation in that it was a great epidemiological
very nice
presentation.
Yeah. You know, well, unfortunately, they've had a lot of practice at doing those.
They did, you know, but they went right back to the principles of good epidemiological investigation, started with that investigation, did the epidemiological curve, investigated those cases, and then the icing on the cake, I guess, which we have now, which was the actual theme of that flash session, was the use of genomics in infection transmission.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're able to then do the genomics on that and demonstrate these samples and these clinical isolates were pretty much identical.
Yeah.
And I think there was 50-odd cases.
Yeah.
50 or 60-odd cases. And they were within 15 or 20 SNPs of each other. So absolutely clear links that was proven then through genomic work. I thought it was a really nice way to see where, you know, 10 years ago we were basically really relying on the epi. And that was the start of this presentation, and then the icing on the cake was the genomics.
Yeah.
So,
the epi gets you a certain way, the genomics just gets you over the line.
So, look, that's been an interesting first couple of hours here at ICMED.
Yeah.
Been enjoyable, massive as ever.
Massive.
Absolutely massive. And
we're both on about 8,000 steps already.
Yeah. And we've got some other ones here in the review coming up later this afternoon, and various other talks. So, we'll be back again.
We will.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everyone.